Why does the SBA not guarantee the protege 100% of the proceeds, Your Honor?
Because 90 or 80 or 75?
Because the small business protege is not in a position to do 100% of all the work on a $165 million contract for the U.S. Army because of the size regulations.
It can always do what it did in this case.
Well, I mean, it has the ability. I guess maybe I misunderstood your question. I think as a matter of potentiality, yes, the protege can do 100%. The only one that's entitled to a minimum work share is...
A rhetorical question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Designed to point out that if the protege can just wait until it's in a position to grab 100% of it, there would be no reason for the mentor to get into it, and the program would have no effect.
Well, the mentor is there for training and to help the protege. The only party in this arrangement who has a work share guarantee of 40% is the protege, and the protege can do up to 100% if it has to. So the SBA regulations recognize that there may be a circumstance like this case where the mentor and the protege do not get along. The JV agreement in this case makes it clear that if we have to do the work that was originally assigned to the mentor...
That's not the ground on which you took over, hijacked the project, is it?
We didn't hijack the project, Your Honor. We canceled a subcontract in reaction to the fact that our mentor had sued us. And so that was...
How much notice did you give them before you...
The termination provision in the subcontract does not have a notice provision.
I didn't ask that. How much notice did you give them?
We didn't give them much notice, Your Honor. It was a day's notice.
And I thought it was 6 hours, 7 hours.
We gave the notice the day before Memorial Day, Your Honor. You're right. And but that was...
Was that good faith?
It was. Well, they had sued us, Your Honor, so you have two parties.
People sue other people all the time. It's nothing personal. But was that in good faith?
Yes, Your Honor, because the contract permitted it. And what has happened here...
Anything the contract permits is in good faith.
Well, there was no termination period. It was for convenience. We didn't have to have an...
What about Baldwin? You cite a few sentences out of Baldwin, but you conveniently leave out all the part where the Delaware Supreme Court last year said there's a obligation of good faith and fair dealing that can't be contracted away.
Well, the Delaware law recognizes that a LLC agreement like this JV is governed by the contract. And the contract here gave
Delaware
up...
Delaware law, Mr. Smith, recognizes what the Delaware Supreme Court says it recognizes.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you know full well what Baldwin says.
Yes, Your Honor. But what the subcontract does is remove any fiduciary obligation. That's clear in the subcontract. And what the district court has done here is specifically enforce not the terms of the subcontract, but it's enforced a contract and then removed several provisions from that contract, including the termination for convenience provision, including the lack of any work share guarantee for the sub. And more importantly, what the court has done and in their theory has done is to collapse Yorktown as a member of the JV and Yorktown as a jobber on the job. And so what happens here is that if they aren't a jobber on the job after the first year guarantee, they are still a member of the joint venture. And our CEO testified to that fact at the transcript on page 263 and page 256.
What's your CEO's name?
His name is Mr. Crawford.
Is he the same one that made the misstatements in the three affidavits?
Yes, Your Honor, and we apologize to the district court and apologize to this.
When did you find out about those misstatements?
As we explained to Judge Burke, we knew that there were inconsistencies, and we were going to clear that up at the preliminary injunction hearing, and we made it clear at the front end, and the lawyer who was doing the examination didn't circle back, and Mr. English dealt with it, and we...
He didn't put in any misstatement. He didn't put in any corrections of any misstatements, did he?
He did on cross, Your Honor, yes, and we then subsequently explained...
Wait. I thought he called the witness. I thought he was your witness.
He did, Your Honor.
All right. And he said, well, there's some statements in there that you need to say something about.
That's correct.
And then he didn't say anything else. He just went about his business.
Well, as the lawyer...
That aside.
Yes, Your Honor.
I just... What happened in this case is I understand Judge Burke getting extremely upset about it, because Mr. Crawford said he knew about it 10 to 12 days before the hearing, and he told the lawyers. And for in his material statements in those affidavits, under penalty of perjury.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then y'all wait till the day of the hearing to say anything about it.
Yes, Your Honor. That was an error for which we've apologized. But
error means you got caught. What is a possible excuse for doing that?
Well, it was, if all I can say is it's in the transcript that we intended to correct it, and it was
on
not
on the day of the hearing.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why didn't you write a letter on the ninth day or the eighth day and say, oops, we made a mistake. We don't want the other side to be misled.
Yes, Your Honor.
And we're wasting their time, and we certainly don't want the court to waste its time preparing for a case that doesn't exist because we tendered false affidavits.
And we apologize for that, and I apologize to this court. But if the district court got frustrated because of that, that's understandable. That is not an issue in front of this court, and we're here to talk about the limits of equity.
It's an issue to the point that the district court said, because of this, I don't believe what they're saying.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm taking that a little further.
Yes, Your Honor.
The district court did, but that's the essence of it. And that was entirely proper.
But that doesn't authorize a chancellor in equity to specifically enforce a contract for a term of years that is this complex and put himself in a position of being a judicial contracts officer for 5 years. That's something that equity abhors. And our position is that notwithstanding the personal jurisdiction issues that we have not brought up in this court, that as a matter of equity...
Wait, you didn't appeal. It's not as though you appealed them and brought them up in briefs. They're not in the first brief or your reply brief.
We did not appeal them, Your Honor, correctly.
So they're out of the case.
But this injunction is so broad, Your Honor, that it goes over the boundaries of proper equity practice insofar as it puts a judicial contracts officer behind our mentor and says with the power of contempt that if you try to deprive your contractual counterparty of any right or any benefit under this contract, then you have to come to the court for judicial approval to do so. That was not the circumstances on the ground. It was not in the bill in equity. And the chancellor is simply not authorized to do that. And the other point that I was making is that equity does not allow a court to rewrite the contract that it's enforcing. This was specific performance of a subcontract to allow Yorktown to be a jobber on the job. But what it does is it covers issues that could all the way to the final issues of default, any right or benefit, we must come through the district court. And that is simply too broad as a matter of equity.
Can you unpack that a little bit more? Why is it too broad?
So you have two joint venture members. The protege is supposed to be the manager, and they are managing all of these work issues that are coming out from the Army. And you can't divide those work streams into decimal point accuracy. The manager has to make a decision as to which subcontractor needs to be handling this question about something that has come up in Ukraine and how are we going to train soldiers to deal with that in the future. And if our counterparty has an argument that we have deprived them of 0.5% of work in the course of developing this contract over 5 years, they're going to have their position. But the judge has said that we can't deprive them of any right or benefit in this contract for a period of 5 years without judicial approval. And so our agents, if the government takes five of those jobs in-house, what our client is doing is not taking those jobs away from Yorktown. It's letting those jobs go from ThreatTech, because if it were to take a job from Yorktown, it might be in contempt of this decree for depriving them of a right or a benefit of the contract. And so What they have is a guarantee of any right or benefit that they want to argue, and they have a judicial backstop.
Well, not that they want to argue, but that they have.
Well, that's what the Supreme Court deals with this in the Rutland Marvel case, Your Honor. And what the issue here in equity is you don't want a chancellor being a judicial contracts referee, whether it's building a railroad or running a quarry or running a $165 million government contract. My opponent has given away his claim for damages about any sort of work share on page 52 of the red brief. He said that that's easy to calculate. Equity doesn't come into play if monetary damages are sufficient, and they are sufficient to deal with that issue. And the only issue that becomes irreparable from their view is loss of business reputation or business opportunities. And the subcontract and the liability of limitation of liability gave that away. And so not only did the district court rewrite rather than enforce the terms of the contract as written, took away not only our right to cancel a subcontract, but took away all these other important rights like the limitation of liability and the fact that they don't have a guaranteed work share. On the overbreath point, just to get a little bit more on the ground for you, Your Honor, paragraph 2 says that not a single agent of my client can take any action to deprive Yorktown of any right or benefit under this JV agreement for the entire term. And that is an exceedingly broad injunction. Those circumstances were not before the court when they filed their motion for TRO, but they now have the district court having to administer this contract for 5 years, just like running a prison or a firefighter department, and that's just something that a district court is not in a good position to deal with when you're dealing with security clearances and, you know, issues of national security for a five-year term.
What should, given the premises that preceded the order page, what should the order have said if the court rules against you, assuming?
Well, the circumstances in the bill in equity by my opponent were that we had given them notice to cancel a subcontract. If they wanted to preserve that status quo for a period of time, the decree should have said, don't cancel the subcontract. That was the only circumstance. But to go so far as to guarantee them a work share of 49.6%, when that was never in the minds of either party, this is a $165 million government contract. Mr. Dyer testified before the district court that he expected his client, Yorktown, to get 45. He expected my client, ThreatTech, to get 46. That's 90. There's a $60 million remainder, and that's to be done by subcontractors like Booz Allen and Microsoft.
I read the order is saying you're prohibited from terminating the subcontract agreement until further order by the court.
That's the first paragraph, correct.
And neither you nor your agents shall take any action to deprive Yorktown of its rights and benefits under the JV agreement. That's basically, you can't terminate that.
Well, the whole dispute in the trial court is about the JV agreement. And any right or benefit was not what the bill was about. The bill was about the first paragraph that you read. And if you'll go back in front of number one there on the previous page, Your Honor, he says even issues of default. And we have a separate section that allows us to cancel them for issues of their default. And the district judge has, that was not presented, just like it wasn't presented in the Rutland Marble case. And the U.S. Supreme Court says that's an overbroad preliminary injunction.
What the court's saying here is you can't do indirectly what I've ordered you not to do directly. And if you have some issue about that, if something comes up about that, come and move the court for an alteration of this order.
Well, I think the indirectly and directly is in paragraph one, but what I'm saying is that issues of default are far beyond what was on the ground at the time, as well as any and every interest.
Y'all can terminate them anytime and just say it's on the grounds of default and nobody can do anything.
No, Your Honor, those issues will be litigated ultimately, and he has said on page 52 that damages are sufficient to work out the remedies in a complex commercial transaction like this. It's just that we now have to go through the district court standing behind them saying, if they say you've deprived me of this interest that was never at issue before now, like moving one of our contractors off the job, our client is operating in fear of contempt. So it's taking those jobs only away from itself, and that makes its work share get smaller, and you're putting at risk the fact that they may not ultimately do 40% of the work on this. And ultimately,
you're advocating for their interest.
It's inverted the hierarchy that this whole program was designed to be. We are now under the negative control of our mentor, and they have a judicial backstop, and equity abhors that.
Thank you. We will now hear from Mr. English.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'm Brad English, and my colleagues and I represent Yorktown. And I want to start with the Rutland Marble case that the plaintiffs have, or that Threat Tech has made such a big deal about. In that case, as Your Honors know, the court said it's inappropriate for the district court to enter a permanent, forever injunction requiring one partner to bring certain qualities of marble to another. And the similar issue in the Texas and Pacific Railway case where the court says you can't enter an injunction requiring somebody to build a railroad. Well, Judge Burke has not ordered anybody to go do this government contract. We all desperately want to go do this work. The first sentence of the opinion past the syllabus in Rutland reads like this: equity will enjoin one partner from violating the rights of his co-partner in partnership matters, although no dissolution of the partnership be contemplated. Judge Burke just stopped one partner from stealing the other partner's work, and that's been good law and allowable under equity since 1870 at least, if not longer. Another point I want to hit just at the beginning, because Judge Carnes asked some questions about it, and Mr. Smith's response seems to indicate that Threat Tech thinks the termination for convenience clause in the subcontract, if it controlled the work, and we agree with Judge Burke it doesn't, would give them just a plenary right to terminate. And I want to point out something that I think is really important. Threat Tech focuses on the language that is the first sentence of the termination for convenience clause. But like a lot of government contracts, this one actually incorporates the FAR. So I'm reading from the subcontract. This is on page 7, paragraph 8.1. So you've got termination for convenience, and you've got the initial, you can terminate for convenience with notice. But the next sentence that they don't focus on says, the rights of the parties pursuant to termination for convenience shall be in accordance with FAR, F-A-R, and that's Federal Acquisition Regulation, 52249-6. However, and then it goes on to give us language of how to substitute these words in the FAR for the words in the subcontract. So in the FAR, when we see government, we substitute Threat Tech or the LLC. And when we see contractor, we substitute Yorktown. And so if you look at the cases that govern the FAR clauses, and there's another one at the tail end of that sentence, which is 52249-2, and there are multiple termination for convenience clauses in the FAR for different types of contracts. There's one for a fixed price contract. There's one that deals with time and materials types contracts, because it works differently from an accounting standpoint when you've got a termination. And so if you look at the cases that interpret that FAR section, which says these are the rights of the parties, termination under that FAR section is subject to abuse of discretion and good faith. And there are a litany of cases that say a contract that's been terminated under one of these termination for convenience clauses that for an abuse of discretion or in bad faith is a breach. And there's a few cases I was going to give the court just to, if you're interested in seeing how that works. And again, you might see multiple termination for convenience clauses, not exactly this one because it's a differently priced contract. But so the seminal case is a case from a sister circuit, the Federal Circuit, I'm going to butcher this name, but it's K-R-Y-G-O-S-K-I Construction, B-U-S. It's at 94 Fed Third, 1537, and the pertinent language is at 1541. And then there's a couple of cases where the meat of this usually gets litigated is at the Boards of Contract Appeal, which are Article II bodies that have Tucker Act jurisdiction coextensive with the Court of Federal Claims to adjudicate disputes between the contractors and the government. So you see a lot of discussions there. That's where a lot of this litigation ends up. And so there's two cases that deal with this specifically, appeal of a Nexigen Networks, which is at 19-1, B as in Boy, C as in Charlie, A as in Alpha, paragraph 37258. It's also at 2019 Westlaw 989651. And then there's another one, the appeal of Sigal, S-I-G-A-L, Construction Corp, which is at 10-1, BCA, paragraph 34442. 2010 Westlaw 2015-3456. The Nexigen case is from the Armed Services Board of Contract Appeal. If you've got a DOD contract, it can go there. The Sugal case is from the Civilian Board, which would only have jurisdiction over contracts awarded by civilian agencies. And so if we look at, if we think about the rules that these parties have agreed apply to their contract, and we look at these cases, how does the court usually adjudge or review for an abuse of discretion? What's the arbitrary and capricious standard? And one of the ways a decision is arbitrary and capricious is if there's no rational reason for it. Well, what did Judge Burke say? They failed entirely to articulate a coherent reason for these actions. So even if the work was controlled by the subcontract, this injunction would have been proper because it was...
Mr. Smith says y'all failed to perform and so forth.
There's no evidence of a failure to perform. They terminated us, as Mr. Smith just said, if I heard him correctly, because we sued them for the work in Florida that they cut us out of, another $450 million of work.
That under the same partnership, mentor?
No, Your Honor. There's some weird rules that were being fleshed out at the time about security clearances and these mentor protégés.
I know, but was that the same basic relationship between y'all that we have before us?
No, sir. It was a traditional prime-sub relationship. This one was...
Not an SBA deal.
Well, it was set aside for small business, but it's not a mentor-protégé relationship that's governed by 13 CFR.
There's bad blood here. Surprise, surprise.
There's some bad blood. That's absolutely right, Your Honor. And their response to our lawsuit was the termination notice on 3 or 5 hours notice or so. I forget exactly when we got it, 5 o'clock or so that night. And so that's where Judge Burke picked up, and he entered a TRO, and then we had a day-long preliminary injunction hearing where he heard extensive evidence from a number of witnesses, and he determined, number one, that we had a likelihood of success on two counts. And the first one is breach of fiduciary duty, which they didn't even address in their opening brief. And Judge Burke said, I've scoured the contracts to determine if there's been a waiver in some fashion of the fiduciary duty. And then he said, it's not in the partnership's interest to terminate your count. And he explained why. And then he went on to say things like terminating the partner that helped you win the work would be the epitome of disloyalty. And going back to the bad faith standard that's applicable under this bar clause, sounds a lot like bad faith to me. He also said things, no coherent reason for this action. And if you see the transcript...
Did TruTech not argue that the reason is they sued us?
I think they did, yes, Your Honor. Now, I don't know if there was a testimony.
That sounds coherent to me. It may not be appropriate or legitimate, but it sounds fairly coherent.
Right. And so that was their basis. But why is that in the best interest of the partnership? Given the regulatory overlay, the joint venture agreement, I'm sure Your Honors have seen it, specifically says nobody can withdraw from this partnership unilaterally. I mean, you know right off the bat when you have an agreement like that, that this is different than your customary partnership for a roofing company or a distributorship or whatever it may be. And so that just sort of is the tip of the iceberg on this regulatory world that these parties are in that brought us before Judge Burke. And you've seen from the regulations, there's a list of things that have to be met in order to qualify
for status as a small business. And if you, you look at the beginning of the regulation, if I can get it out, it tells you how, I want to read this correctly if I can, so let me grab it. The first part of 13 CFR 125.8 tells you, generally, a joint venture of two or more business concerns may submit an offer as a small business for federal procurement. Not, here's how you bid on a small business contract. This is how you claim small business status for any contract, which is what they did. They promised the government that following these regs, we'd be a small business. And it goes on with a number of requirements. And so one of the reasons Judge Burke found this wasn't in the joint venture's interest is because if you don't follow the regulations, then we're affiliated. We're both big. We're not small if we don't follow these regulations. And we're a large business. And so the court has an affiliation case under the FAR, Agility Defense and Government Services. This is a little different type of affiliation that arises out of small business regulations. And it tells us how to count size. How big is a company? When you're affiliated, we add your size together. So at the time, the testimony, I believe, is that ThreatTech was about a $7 million company in Yorktown. I think Mr. Dyer testified, it's certainly a large business. I think he said it was a lot larger, maybe $80 to $100 million.
That's a big difference.
It is, right. But if we don't follow these regulations, then we're added together, so it'd be $87 million. And so that 76.4% small business work share that we promised the government that's now been incorporated in the government contract, it's going to go to zero. Because both of us are treated as large if we're affiliated. There's a lot of draconian results that will follow if we don't follow these regulations. And Judge Burke stopped it for that reason, too, because getting suspended or barred, which is one of the potential consequences of not following this regulation. Again, if you read that section of the regulation, it doesn't say on a small business procurement. It says just failure to perform according to the joint venture.
What about their argument? What I take to be their argument, no big deal, just sue us for damages. You've done it before, do it again.
So, I'm sorry, were you finished, Your Honor?
Sure.
So, Judge Burke made a finding on that, a finding of fact, based on the evidence that's subject to the clear error standard. I don't think they've articulated any clear error. But he found, not just that we're going to lose the profit, and I agree, we can go add that up, but we're going to lose 95 highly skilled employees who are doing intelligence work for the military. They're hard to find, and they had already started being solicited by ThreatTech. You saw that in the record as well. So they're already moving our people. The government's been alerted to this by ThreatTech, and they're saying, hey, go apply for your job, because the government can't withstand losing 95 people doing that work like that either. And so we're going to lose all that capability. We'll lose the connection with the customer. Mr. Dyer, who's sitting behind us, testified that ISR, this intelligence work, is the future of the company, and they're going to strip that away. And Mr. Dyer also testified that in addition to losing those 95 people, there's headquarters staff that they would have to lay off that they had trained for years if this work went away. So there was significant corporate impact that went beyond just trying to calculate the loss of this work. And there was also prejudice from a reputational standpoint because the government's been alerted, hey, we're kicking Yorktown off. You're a $7 million company. We're a $100 million company. We're getting kicked off this contract. That has a reputational harm that Judge Burke found to be very real. And it also has a harm in the sense of what we call past performance. So when the government evaluates bidders for a contract, it's got to do what amounts to a reference check if you're hiring somebody. So you submit past performance references that say, look at what I've done in the past. Here's some work I did that's similar. Well, if we're going to bid on other ISR work in the future, which is the goal, given that it's the future of the company, we're going to need to claim past performance for this work. Well, they're going to strip that away from us. And so a really close case we cite in our brief is the Beacon case, which is a District of D.C. case, but it arises out of Anniston at the depot up there. So you had two contractors that were warring. They weren't in a protege relationship. They were just in a traditional prime sub setting. And for reasons that the district court there found to be objectionable, the prime kicked the sub off the contract, terminated it for convenience, and took 40 workers immediately. And you'll see in that case the judge going through the same analysis we see from Judge Burke, talking about the reputational harm, talking about the loss of institutional knowledge, the loss of capacity, the loss of the ability to claim past performance. And so I think that the Threat Tech pretty clearly has failed to explain in any way other than some commercials about how it's speculative. They haven't explained how Judge Burke's findings are clear error.
But that you can't just easily dismiss the speculative argument. I mean, other than the employees that you were able to identify who are already being recruited, if not already moved to another job, what other evidence other than Mr. Dyer's testimony or affidavit did you have to ground those allegations?
Well, in Mr. Dyer and Ms. Matthew, the CEO, and or excuse me, the president, I'm going to run over time. Is it okay if I finish my answer? They both testified to the loss not only of the 95 people that were direct charged on the contract, but also all of the people at headquarters they wouldn't be able to pay for. But the other concrete immediate harm is being kicked out of the TRADOC G2 customer. Because that is the only connection, as Mr. Dyer testified, that Yorktown has with G2. That's where this ISR intelligence work is coming from. Right now, they're performing 49.6% of the work or thereabouts. They have contact with that customer. The minute we're terminated, we have no reason to be in front of that customer. We have no reason to be on base. All our access will be terminated because we don't have a basis for being on site. And so that was another immediate harm that was going to be suffered by Threat Tech, given the testimony that was undisputed about the future of this company and the desire to go after this ISR work in the future. Now, I'll grant you there's upcoming competitions, and that's a little bit far afield, but the immediacy of the separation from the customer was just one of many things that Judge Burke said would happen and constituted irreparable harm.
So it just sounds as if you're arguing that some would say that this David would be able to completely topple Goliath based on this desire to separate?
Well, it would certainly cause us irreparable harm, I would say, Your Honor, because of the things that I just mentioned. Topple is one thing. Certainly for this contract, it would topple us. And Mr. Dyer testified that this is the only ISR intelligence capacity they have in the company, and they will lose those 95 people. With it will go that institutional knowledge. So it's not just bidding on future contracts, which is real, and you'll see that in Beacon too. It's real in our world, but it's the immediate loss of the capability they've spent money and time developing over these years that's all focused on this one contract and one customer at that time.
Let me ask you one thing, Mr. English. When did you hear about the corrections to the affidavit?
The ones that were filed, Your Honor?
They were filed later, but the hearing, in relation to the hearing.
So if you look at the transcript from the TRO hearing that we had on May 27, in that hearing it came up that the affidavits that had been filed swore that there was no work in Birmingham. And you'll see in the transcript, I tell Judge Burke, I am holding job announcements for Alabama. There was a part of the work in Florida that's not an issue in this case that's being done at the National Guard office in Birmingham. So we knew that day. And if you see my last, I guess, recross of Mr. Mitchell, I asked him, did you read that transcript? And he said, yes, the transcript of the May 25th hearing. And so when he said that I've only known for 10 days or so, they knew there was a problem about that in May. And the hearing where we corrected it all in my cross was in August.
Right, but you also knew in May, right?
I knew about that.
The ones you didn't know about, when did you find out about them?
I would say, generally, Your Honor, a couple weeks before the hearing, we had asked the lawyers who weren't involved now. We were primarily dealing with Williams Mullen, and I don't know how active my friends at Bradley were at the time, because Williams Mullen was taking the lead, Mr. O'Toole. And so we had asked Mr. O'Toole about the contracts that he filed. Because one of the things I pointed out with Mr. Mitchell was that the contracts that he said they filed, or maybe it was the proposals, were complete, and there was only one volume.
Condensed.
Sir, several weeks before that, we had asked them about filing the entire contract or proposal, and they said we filed what we intended to, even though the affidavit said it was all of it. It was incomplete. The rest of it, I realized, getting ready for the cross probably the night before.
You recognized, when did you have that information? or did you just discover the inconsistencies yourself?
I discovered most of it getting ready to cross, Your Honor. So the night before the hearing is when I flagged most of it, other than the two things I've mentioned.
You seem to be fairly well prepared for the cross.
Right. They filed their affidavits back in May, and maybe one in early June. So we had had those for several weeks.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Mr. Smith, you've got 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. My opponent suggests that these two parties must be welded together, and he's cited some FAR sections, but I think it's important to look at the regulation that governs this. 125.8B, Romanet 8, makes it clear that the protege will have to finish all of the work on the prime contract, even if the mentor withdraws. And the subcontract makes this clear. If you'll look at the subcontract, section 8.3, it says that if the joint venture terminates Yorktown for convenience or for default, it can either acquire substitute services or under the JV, it could do the work itself. He also has argued about lost business opportunities and business reputation. All of that was waived in section 44 of the subcontract. It has a limitation of liability. It's on page 107 of document 8.1. And so what has happened here is the district court has excised those paragraphs that gave the protege control in this situation and inverted that power hierarchy. And that ends up creating a situation of involuntary servitude, which the old Fifth Circuit has said you cannot have. The Corin Sweat case that's cited in our briefs is 594 F. 2nd at 134 note 3. And the old Fifth Circuit makes it clear that a chancellor in equity cannot weld parties together who no longer want to work together. And it's clear that these parties do not want to work together. But I want to, in parting, say that just because they're not a jobber on the job does not mean that they are no longer a member of this JV. And this JV has a prime contract for $165 million. They will be entitled to distributions, as my client admitted at the hearing on the preliminary injunction. They will remain a JV member. They just were not entitled to be a jobber. And so,
what do you mean by they'll remain, but there won't be a job?
If you have a two-member close corporation, Your Honor, and you have a CEO and a COO, and they both have shares, 50-50, the CEO can fire the COO. The COO no longer has a job, but the COO is entitled as a minority member of that close corporation to distributions from that company. And in the same way, Yorktown is a member of this JV, is entitled to profits from this prime contract. And just because it's not working as a subcontractor, it is still a member and still entitled to distribution.
49%.
Well, it's a little more complicated, but in terms of, well, reality is that the profit is coming from subcontractors like Booz Allen, because the JV makes it clear that the two members have their profits baked into their rates. So the profit comes from the $60 million remainder that was to be done by third parties. And so the regulations make it clear that in that JV, any monies left is to be divided by ownership. So it's 51-49.
And why the fact that they sued you on a totally independent project mean that you can't work together on this project?
Well, I don't think I've convinced you of this, but the termination provision is not for cause. It's an at-will termination with no, and I know that's dissatisfying.
Delaware Supreme Court.
But the fact of the matter is that our mentor sued us, and that was, and their client testified in his affidavit that the relationship had soured after the lawsuit, even before the lawsuit. That's in Mr. Dyer's affidavit.
Why did it sour before the lawsuit?
I don't know all of those details to give you a short answer, but I can say that damages are more than adequate to resolve all of this, Your Honor, and this injunction we asked to be vacated for violating the principles of equity that we've gone over. Thank you.
Thank Thank you. We'll move to our next case.